Welcome to another episode of Evidence-Based GI, an ACG podcast. I'm Dr. Eliezer Montalban, a second-year gastroenterology and hepatology fellow at Yale University. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Eli Alkassi. He is an assistant professor of medicine at the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, where he wears many hats, including serving as an associate editor of Evidence-Based GI. He's a foremost expert in IBD, and today he's here to walk us through the updated ulcerative colitis guideline, recently published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology. The last version was in 2019, and in the past 6 years, we have seen a real explosion in UC research and treatment options. Dr. Alkassi, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Eliezer. I really appreciate the opportunity and chatting with you as well.
Dr. Alkassi, to start us off, can you give our listeners a quick summary, a brief one, of the new guidelines of UC management in that, of the ACG guidelines?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, Eliezer, I completely agree. There have been a lot of new findings and a lot of good evidence coming out in the past 6 years from the most recent updates. And it was definitely a very difficult feat for all of the authors to create these guidelines. In really kind of a very quick summary, it's a very extensive, good guidelines that really integrate a lot of the great evidence portfolio of the statement that were written, but also there have been a component in them as well after that for a consensus, for consensus statements, especially when the evidence was lacking. If we focus a little bit our attention more to the great guidelines or the actual guidelines that came out, there have been good changes, and most importantly, some of the changes more in management rather than diagnosis. So the new guidelines have integrated the new kind of medication that have been there or have been even introduced, especially including more data we have now on deficiency, the safety profile of JAK inhibitors. We have two of them now on the interleukin medication as well, such as guselkumab, risankizumab, and ustekinumab, and also some guidelines or guidance on the use of biosimilars. When it comes to the hospitalized patient with acute UC, I'm sure we'll discuss that in a later point during this podcast. But there have also been some changes as well then we can approach shortly.
Excellent summary. That really set the stage for the rest of our discussion. So let's start at the foundation. How do we diagnose ulcerative colitis?
The diagnosis honestly remains the same. You start with a good, strong clinical suspicion when it comes to ulcerative colitis. And it's really ruling out C. diff remains a very important step in ulcerative colitis and in IBD in general. We do have more and more evidence on against the use of any serology to rule out or determine the prognosis of UC. So in kind of a small summary, the ulcerative colitis diagnosis remains to be done after a rule out of C. diff, and then we really focus on an endoscopy and pathology to help us differentiate that from Crohn's disease and some of the biochemical markers as well.
That's a clear framework. Thank you. So in 2019, fecal calprotectin was highlighted as part of the diagnostic and monitoring process. What is the role of calprotectin in UC?
Yeah, so as we mentioned, the past 6 years, we've had stronger evidence and recommendation on the use of fecal calprotectin in the disease. At the moment, our recommendation is to use fecal calprotectin in assessing response to therapy, especially during maintenance. With that, I think fecal calprotectin has a very strong role on the routinely monitored labs, other than your good old CBC and CMP. CRP now and fecal calprotectin both play very strong roles in disease monitoring. With that being said, both inflammatory markers, the CRP and fecal calprotectin, can be used in also predicting possible relapse down the road for the disease. But at the moment, it really remains a good assessment to response to therapy.
That's a practical way of looking at it. How about when we are starting therapies for patients with UC? How do you choose the first treatment? What are the recommendations for mild, moderate, and severe disease?
Definitely. So I'm very happy. And also, I feel our patients are very fortunate that now we have multiple medications. We have multiple different classes of disease, of treatment medications, but also different medications within each class. And these really provide some versatility for our patients. And as we mentioned, the patient remains the center of it all and the disease as well. So the first step really remains on kind of characterizing the disease. So a couple of things that will help us do that is disease severity, disease extent, that will really are really helpful in order to us to, with the patient, get down to remission. So when we are labeling patients at mild to moderate category, our still main medication remains the 5-ASA, being rectal or topical or systemic. There's the use of budesonide, kind of remains, is also to be considered oral budesonide as an induction of remission that can help us, you know, get patients into remission and then plan with them the maintenance regimen after they get to remission. When it comes to when the patient moves into the category of moderate to severe, this is when we start considering the different biologics we have. One thing to keep in mind is that the way our medical system functions is that a good amount of our patients move into the moderate to severe category during a hospitalization or after a hospitalization. So that switch is usually dictated by what is available for the hospitalized patient. We will discuss this later on, but the options we have currently are infliximab with an infliximab loading regimen for the acute severe hospitalized patient. And in some patients, we do have options for a JAK inhibitor as well. That being said, when our patient kind of moves into the severe, moderate to severe category, we can discuss with them what's the most appropriate regimen. Factors that really go into this decision and help patient make this decision are a couple of them. One important one is patients who are, for example, planning on getting pregnant within a year of initiating any advanced therapy. We cannot really do the JAK inhibitors at that point. So we'll have to lean toward the more approved medication in pregnancy that are safer, for example, anti-TNFs. Other consideration are patients who have other, for example, autoimmune diseases, patients who have active cancers and whatnot. In addition, unfortunately, you know, the healthcare system that relies heavily on insurance companies have also some dictation on that. But again, these guidelines are really hoping to guide insurance companies as well as us on what is a good recommendation or strong recommendation for initiating this advanced therapy. The third part remains that we can always ask the patient about their quality of life and what kind of works with them. For example, patients who are healthcare providers themselves, patients who work shift, third shift, or night shift, it might be a little bit more difficult for them to schedule infusions at infusion centers. But we can work with the insurance companies to get them infusions at home if that is possible. Or we can talk to the patient and kind of gear toward an injectable medication rather than infusion, where they can do it, you know, at their own convenience. These are all things, again, that can help patients, but more importantly is that what is medically safe and efficacious for our patients have to be kind of presented to our patients, and then the patients can make their own decision on which one to choose. One thing to really note is that the paucity of head-to-head trials in ulcerative colitis really remain a challenge for all of us in order to help us position some medications better than others. We do have the Varsity trial that is included in this guideline that really kind of told us that vedolizumab, you know, is a better or could be a better medication than adalimumab. But beyond that, at the moment, for data that is strong and kind of safe, that's the only RCT we have. But there are definitely additional studies that are being done at the moment to look into different head-to-head trials, but also some combination therapy that can help, where we can use some medication during the induction in addition to a biologic, and then drop this medication and continue this biologic later on.
Thank you for that really clear explanation. So one new addition to the guidelines is intestinal ultrasound. What role does it play in UC management?
Yes, so this intestinal ultrasound are really becoming a new way for us to quickly and safely kind of assess disease activity in our patients. So talking about our treat to target really remains endoscopic healing, endoscopic remission. So going to or reaching Mayo 1 or Mayo 0 scoring, right? But we do have a growing body of evidence where we can utilize intestinal ultrasound at bedside for really no risks at all, no anesthesia risk, no procedure risk from a flex sigmoidoscopy or a colonoscopy, in order to help us assess disease monitoring and how our patients are doing. As I mentioned earlier, when we talked a little bit about fecal calprotectin and CRP, UC management really remains a very dynamic process. Patients should always be monitored as frequently as indicated as possible. For example, whenever we're starting a new biologic, we really need to have a new set of data points at week 8, for example, to see how the disease is progressing and how we're getting to healing or to remission. So at the moment, intestinal ultrasound remains a very promising additional tool in our diagnostic and prognostic or basket, but we still need a little bit more evidence. So I'm very much hopeful that the next iteration of these guidelines will have stronger evidence and stronger data to integrate the use of intestinal ultrasound and the management of our UC patients.
Fantastic. I love how you framed that. So now let's shift to acute severe ulcerative colitis. How do we define acute severe ulcerative colitis?
I mean, this remains kind of the same. I mean, other than the fact that what we have, the data, it's always when you see a patient like, this patient's not doing well at all. But in a more, obviously, objective measurement, this is when there is very much an increase in bowel habits, diarrhea, frequency, urgency, when you have increased bleeding. So when your Mayo score, for example, is definitely increasing, and there is a sign of toxicity. So, and this is defined by either toxic megacolon, septic shock, hemorrhage, and things like that.
And when it comes to management, have there been any notable changes or new recommendations in these update guidelines?
Honestly, at this current iteration of the guidelines, not really. But there are really good promising data points that are going to be included open in the next one. Steroids, really, systemic steroids, IV, remains the first-line therapy for these patients. And I would really urge the listeners to take a look at figure 4. Of the guidelines that really presents a very neat algorithm for assessing patients and managing them once they get to the hospital. Most importantly is just want to make sure that there is no infectious colitis that's also driving the disease. But once we really make sure that it is actually ASUC or the acute severe ulcerative colitis, you know, more than 6 bowel movement a day and one of the toxic kind of toxic, either toxic megacolon, tachycardia, fever, low hemoglobin or high CRP, then this is when we start steroids. We really assess for clinical response. If we don't find a clinical response by day 3, then that's when we do evaluate or we do initiate IV infliximab or IV cyclosporin. So this remains to be, you know, the guidelines. We do have growing evidence, for example, the new TACO trial that looked into the addition of tofacitinib in these patients. This is a single-center trial that looked at tofacitinib versus steroids, and it did show that there is possibly a role of tofacitinib. Unfortunately, at the moment, we haven't really had any comparison of head-to-head of any of the JAK inhibitors versus infliximab. So we we really still recommend infliximab as this first line of therapy. Infliximab and cyclosporine as first line therapy for ASUC who have not had any clinical response after initiating steroids.
And finally, what's the role of colorectal surgery in the management of acute severe ulcerative colitis?
From the guideline basis, the recommendation is that at day three that you involve colorectal surgery for when patients do not respond, don't have any clinical response for steroids. In our practice, we have been involving colorectal surgery on admission because, again, this is a very dynamic disease state. Sometimes things turn south faster than we even recognize. For example, when you have signs of toxic megacolon at day two, we are not going to wait, oh, this has to be our day three thing before we involve them. Our surgical colleagues really can provide good guidance and good options, especially when they are involved first. It might be beneficial for patients as well to meet the surgeon when things are not too hot yet, because again, things can go south very quickly in some of our patients. And all of this really this guidelines kind of also shed the light on this. Though the past 6 years have given us a huge amount of data that have helped us really establish more guidelines, but the key concepts are still plenty, and we are really lacking strong evidence that would help us move these statements from key concept statements to actual grade guidelines. Other than these guidelines providing us good, strong clinical guidance in treating patients, I think it's also a good roadmap for what the next step in research also can be. This is where researchers can look into these key concepts and try to move the evidence from key concept to strong guidelines and strong recommendations to help move the needle forward in caring for all of our UC patients, the mild to moderate, moderate to severe, and obviously the acute severe patients who are hospitalized.
Well, Dr. Alkassi, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. For more evidence-based GI and ACG podcasts, be sure to subscribe and follow along. You can read the full June issue of the American Journal of Gastroenterology for all the details on these updates in ulcerative colitis guidelines. And don't forget to check your inbox for your monthly evidence-based GI email. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.